morning and welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. With me in the studio is an out-of-town guest. It is our honor to have with us a poet and writer, Sheila Nickerson from Juneau. And also in the studio with me are Jane Pender, Sally Yari, and Pat Monahan. And we're going to talk about women and writing. And certainly we're going to talk about Sheila's writing and the book which has just been published, the first book published by Vanessa Press, which is Alaska's first feminist press. And the book is called On Why the Quilt Maker Became a Dragon, a Visionary Poem. And the reason that we have the honor of Sheila being in our studio with us is she's up here promoting her book.
Well, it's a great honor to be here, and it's very exciting to be here, too, for the first anniversary of Vanessa Press, which is something I think women and people, not only in Alaska, but everywhere, can feel very proud about. I think it's a real coming of age for Alaska.
I don't know how many of the members in the radio audience this morning happened to catch the show that I did in January on small presses, but for those of you who did hear that program, they are aware that small presses have their own sets of problems, their own freedoms, their own opportunities to publish things that don't necessarily have to be immediate bestsellers, but of course then there's lots of financial difficulties and distribution difficulties.
But speaking of immediate bestsellers, I think that, and I'll speak for Sally, who is more connected with Vanessa Press than I am, Sheila's book has been out for 4 months and already half of the first press run has sold, which is staggering in the small press world, just staggering. Hundreds of copies per month of the book are being bought, and it's only yet been distributed in Alaska because it's so new. And I think that's a tremendously exciting indication of the interest that the readership has in Alaskan women's work.
And this is not a book on how to get slim thighs in 30 days. This is
quite the contrary.
Because there's great incentive to buy those books, but this is poetry, and poetry is notoriously a poor seller, or I don't know.
It's a slow seller.
A slow seller, excuse me. Definitely. It just, generally, even poetry by very well-known poets does not sell in the millions of copies.
Now, about 1,500 copies nationally of a book of poetry is considered a very fine sales record for the first year. So
okay, that sort of puts us in
well in competition, I would say.
And of course that is with very well-known poets.
Yes.
We're talking about all poets.
Mm-hmm. 1,500 copies.
But again, on the subject of poetry selling, a recent announcement on what poems are selling was in Writer's Digest, and columnist Judson Jerome, who writes about poetry, said there are certain kinds of poetry that's selling, and mentioned the three best-selling poets today, who are Carolyn Forché, Entezaki Shange, and Erica Jong, and made a terrific analysis of why they're selling, that they speak to really relevant points in your life, and they're accessible and so forth, neglected to mention that they're all women. How this escaped him, I don't know, but it seems to me that what we have in women's poetry is an audience that transcends what I think happens in America today, which is that people don't read poetry. It's not a very literate people that I know with degrees from Harvard will say, I don't read poetry. They would never say, I don't listen to opera. I don't read novels. I don't read nonfiction. But they will say, I don't read poetry, as though that's okay. And so you have a kind of tendency in America today to think that poetry is something that you can avoid. But women are buying poetry. It must be women that's buying the poems, because they're all women poets that are the bestsellers. So I think there's a real audience there for poetry in the women's market.
Is it perhaps that form is one that's very accessible to women? They have time to really absorb a poem?
Short books. Yes, that's possible. I think it was interesting. I taught Pat's class. I subbed for her a few weeks ago, and I was doing some reading around women's presses. And I read that the women's movement and the publishing part of the women's movement evolved through poetry. It started out by women publishing their friends or self-publishing, and it all evolved through poetry and into other genres. But that was the basis for it, and I think that has continued and developed over the last decade, definitely.
I know that women have a special affinity for the form diary writing, journal keeping, that's something that we have historical records that women have done that. And in many ways, there are periods of time that's the only record we have of women's thought, because it wasn't sort of recorded in government and so on. But do you think women also have a special relationship to poetry? I mean, through time, is there evidence of that?
Well, I think it's a question of immediacy and universality. And I think when a poem is good and deals with the concrete objects and the things of daily life, that it does reach beyond all social barriers, all geographical barriers, and that women do have a special ability to deal with the concrete of daily life, and through that to reach a universality, so that what we are talking about really is poetry as a universal medium of communication, and I think women are particularly suited to that.
There is that thing that happens when you read a verse of a poem that just speaks to you, of just flashed enlightenment. That's it. That's it exactly.
Yes.
She or he just said, describe something, put words to a feeling that I've had 100 times, and it's just right. And maybe for many of us who don't have time to sort of articulate our feelings and all the sort of complex emotions that we have to go through in a day, that's a real comfort.
Absolutely. And I think it gets into this subject that we've been talking a little bit about of right brain, left brain activity. And I think women are more given, at least, to expressing intuitive feelings. And as you say, the poem, of course, is just based on that immediate sense of illumination. And I think that women have been able to speak through that medium and, again, achieve a universal illumination. The moment is captured and given.
Yes, I was thinking intuitive also as you were talking, It's a particular form of expression that seems to me to be characteristic of women. And it is a kind of a relationship between what goes on in the left brain, maybe, and combined with the facts of life, the practical matters that we all have to deal with daily.
For the sake of our audience who may not all have been following this latest left brain, right brain theory, what are the differences in the properties that they... could you sort of just give us a basic summary of this late thinking on a simple level?
Yeah, just a kind of a capsule. The left brain is... supposed to be the emotional, intuitive, music-loving, poetry-loving.
That's the left part.
Left, right.
I get my left and right confused.
Yeah. And the other side of the brain is the practical part that deals with all the things that are going on in the world.
Data processing, logical progression.
Right, exactly.
The
objectivity,
yes. Mathematical skills.
Right. And so maybe what we're talking about is a kind of a joining of the two.
A bridge.
A bridge.
I think the poem is the natural bridge between the two.
Yeah.
Well, also, recent studies have showed that maybe it's conditioning, but women have more connection between the two parts of the brain. They're less isolated from each other. And so... the bridging back and forth between the ordinary, mundane parts of life and the imaginative, creative parts are not perhaps as difficult. On the other hand, it seems that in the tradition, the grand tradition of poetry, which those of us who are English majors were brought up with, we don't find women. You know, Emily Dickinson is there, finally, in the actual way she wrote it, although for many years Emily Dickinson was published with punctuation provided by editors who believed that she was illiterate enough not to have known punctuation, and so they repunctuated all her work. And it was only about 10 years ago that what Emily Dickinson really wrote was published, and it's created a furor in the academic community because they've had to read what she really intended, which was a lot more challenging and less less comfortable in its original. But other than Emily Dickinson, it's really possible to get a master's in English, as I did, without having read any other female poet in class.
What about Sylvia Plath?
At the time I got my master's, Sylvia Plath was not in the canon. You did not read her in class. I got my master's at the University of Minnesota in 1971. And literally the only woman writer, the only woman poet, we read George Eliot, we read Jane Austen, but the only woman poet we read was Emily Dickinson. And then we read one poem in one class by Marianne Moore. And that was it. Mm-hmm. And so in the tradition, in the canon of English literature, women are not part of it. I read The Pearl Poet, and I didn't read Adrienne Rich. Well, of course, Adrienne Rich was barely known at that time. The many, many writers I was able to consider myself educated and not have read. And I see the huge and growing audience for women's poetry being almost exclusively female. I know many, many educated men who do not read women's writing, and yet I know very few women who consider themselves educated without having read Milton, educated in English literature. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of crossing over where women are reading the male tradition and men are not yet reading the women's tradition. And there is a tradition growing, themes that are evolving in women's writing. Certain relationships, certain visions of the world. And I think it's unfortunate that teachers and poets who are men are not also engaging themselves in the challenging aspects of the female tradition.
It takes time to change those traditions.
And I would point out the only reason why we have Emily Dickinson is purely accident, simply that her manuscripts were not destroyed. And if it hadn't been for the fact that one woman, Helen Hunt Jackson, gave her some support, she might not even have gone on writing, as she said, her letter to the world that would not write to her. It is purely a wonderful accident that her manuscripts were saved at all and not destroyed. And this brings up what Tilly Olson says in Silences, which is that the greatest silences have been experienced by women. And it's not just a question of their not having written, but the fact that their work has never been included or very, very seldom in college courses, for instance. If you were to go into the syllabus of the period that you were talking about, Pat, across the nation, you would find exactly what you experienced. And I wonder if we're doing much better today.
I remember on my final at the University of Minnesota, I had to name all the works of Max Beerbohm. Now, probably few people in the listening audience, and I see from the faces here, few people in the audience at all know who Max Beerbohm is. He's a, you know, 19th century late Victorian writer. I was not required to read the works of Virginia Woolf. And when I look back on my academic training, I think in terms of Max Beerbohm versus Virginia Woolf rather consistently.
But don't teachers teach what they were taught? And so it takes time to make those alterations in curriculum and to start valuing things that weren't part of your educational background. I'm not saying that it isn't done all the time, but then that becomes a special course called contemporary lit versus classical, the classical 200 great books of Western civilization or whatever we're talking about. With me in the studio are Sheila Nickerson, Pat Monahan, Sally Yari, and Jane Pender, and we're talking about women and writing. Sheila, when did you start writing? Were you very young?
Very young, yes. From the time I can first remember, I was writing. I always wanted to write. But I think like many, many people coming out of a traditional classical education, I never really understood what writing was. And it was always held up to me as something rather arcane. And I had gone through a very formal education before I ever learned what the trade instruments are for actually getting a poem not just written, but marketed. And it wasn't until I had dropped out of graduate school and took a night course at the Extension Service at the University of Colorado in Denver on how to publish what you write that I began to learn about the mechanics of how to publish. And that was when my education in writing and publishing really began.
So it wasn't just that you didn't have women as models to follow, but also that you really, at an early age, didn't think of writing as a possible choice to make for a profession?
Well, interestingly enough, I always knew that I wanted to be a professional writer, but I didn't know how to go about doing it. And all through my years at college, I seemed to get no closer to that. And now that I have been involved for some years in writing and publishing, I am very, very interested in the subject of what Maslow calls primary creativeness in writing and how it is triggered. And one of my great aims is to help people to understand that anyone, absolutely anyone who can speak is a writer already and has everything within himself or herself that is necessary. And it's simply a question of learning how to discover what is there and to release it. And there is now, finally, the beginnings of a literature on this subject of triggering, or what I call the genre of discovery.
There seems to be some short circuit when most of us sit down with we can sit down with our thoughts, but to sit down and put a pencil in hand and a piece of paper in front creates a sort of great blankness and panic.
Yes, great fear. And we all have experienced it, and it goes back to what we were saying about how teachers teach what they have learned themselves. And I think there's a tremendous fear right now in most elementary classrooms when it comes to the subject of poetry. And my experience has been teaching children that it's far better never to use the word poetry or even the term writing, if I can possibly avoid it, and simply to keep to terms such as word games or playing with words, anything to avoid that very frightening term of poetry.
Children actually come out with some very poetic images, really nice statements that you will see on the bottom of their pictures or something to explain, almost like haiku.
Yes, because if they're young enough, they haven't learned to be terrified to put down their feelings on paper.
And they haven't learned that there's a right way and a wrong way. That
yes.
Well, what is the source of that terror?
Well, I think being brought to task, being told, well, that doesn't make any sense. I think metaphor is the most important part of language and probably of all of our communication. And yet, how many children, how many of us have been told when we say a tree is a star, that is crazy, that it doesn't make any sense? And we have to understand that whatever we see, our reality is what reality is to us, and that we have every right to believe what we believe. And at the point when children begin to realize that they will be criticized, that they will be told they are crazy for saying something or seeing something in a certain way, then they pull back. And that, to me, is the saddest process that happens when we begin to close down what is inside us.
Might that also be something that's happened to women? If especially now we have, in fact, a lot of women writers and an increasing number of women writers who are being published regularly, and we have access to their work. But it wasn't that long ago, as Pat was talking about going to school in the 50s, that poetry aside, was it 60s?
I think it was 60s.
Oh, university, right. Excuse me. At any rate, that we didn't have a lot of women's viewpoint in the reading that we did, and that made our experience seem different. Or when there's a right way to view things, when heroic topics include men and war and certain kinds of brave incidents, the life of a woman traditionally may have seemed much more mundane, not worthy of great prose or poetry effort.
There's been a lot of writing recently on, I would say it is philosophy, although it's usually put under women's studies. Works like Susan Griffin's Woman in Nature, The Roaring Insider, an attempt to break through our culture and its biases. among them are the mind-body split, the idea that mind is somehow not connected to body. I remember when I took contemporary philosophy, I had a lot of trouble with the mind-body split. I later realized it was because I didn't experience it, and I didn't believe it because I didn't have one. And I think I was trying to learn to have one at that time so that I could be in the mainstream of Western philosophy. And I think that if men's poetry has grown out of the same source as men's philosophy and men's religion, and it involves a mind-body split, then the poetry is likely to be very different than the poetry of people who don't have that. And a lot of women philosophers, including Mary Daly, are grappling with the question of what philosophically is it to be a woman. And I think that women poets are engaged in the same struggle, trying to figure out from the inside what is it to be a woman, to be the agent through which birth comes into the world, therefore death. These are things that men do not experience biologically. So I think that naturally there's a difference in the viewpoint or the outlook, and a different philosophy grows from that. And I think that one of the struggles that women poets have is naming things correctly, not naming them in the way that they've been previously named in the given phrases, the given understandings, but really getting down to bedrock and saying something that is true from the experience. And that's a real challenge. It's a real difficult thing to do.
Judy Chicago talked about that quite a bit in Anchorage when she was here, saying that when she'd done her research for the Birth Project, there were very few crowning images in Western civilization's art history. And of course, that doesn't mean that men or people in general don't think that that's a valuable image. It's simply that if men are the ones who are creating art, that's not part of their experience, and then they wouldn't use it. And then if we as women come along after and become artists, we have to understand that we shouldn't only base our images on our learning, but also on our experience. And I think that's a difficult thing to do at the beginning. Have you felt a lot of changes in your writing and what you've wanted to write about, Sheila, as you've sort of developed those ideas?
Yes, very much so. And Pat mentioned a critical phrase, critical to me anyway, from the inside. I think one of the things that we're talking about is that we have been used to the male journey, the epic form, and everything related to that, whereas women are more inclined to be concerned with the interior journey. And I certainly have become increasingly concerned with my interior journey, which might not have the trappings of an epic journey, but all the same, that is what my life and my spiritual evolution is all about. And I'm concerned with consciousness and the realm of the interior. And I think what we are beginning to be aware of now is women speaking on their interior journeys.
On why the quilt maker became a dragon. This is a kind of journey.
That's exactly what it is, yes. It is a vision of my journey, my changing as I reevaluate my life. And I am concerned with the history, the context, the physical setting in which I live, but also my changing reaction and my deliberate and conscious attempt to change the patterns of my life within the patterns of the historical context.
Since, unfortunately, I think it's safe to assume that not everyone in the audience has had an opportunity to read this visionary poem, could you talk a little bit about the form that it does take? The wonderful metaphor, which is a woman's task of quilt making, of stitching a life, and it's something that in Fairbanks we have so many quilt makers. We have a very active guild is the word. And this whole renaissance of Amish quilts from a number of parts of the country, where they're saying that was an expression of women's art, the making of quilts, the sitting down and talking about their lives together. And because it wasn't in a frame, it didn't get put in museums, and it wasn't called art. Now, that's not to say that all quilts are art, any more than all oil painting is art. So, but you take that image, that idea, and there's a wonderful embroidering of quilt pattern names through the poem, and they really are very poetic names.
Mm. Well, they're wonderful names, and what is interesting is that not only are there hundreds and hundreds of them across the country, but that they vary from one geographical area to another and from one period to another, and yet there are certain crossovers and combinations. And I think there's very interesting work for an anthropologist to really analyze how the quilt names, mm-hmm. how the pattern titles evolved mm-hmm. from one period in one part of the country to another. And that indicates, too, that there certainly was a communication going on that wasn't recognized as such, but which we begin to be aware of now, that women, in effect, were speaking to each other across time and across space through these amazing patterns, some of which have lasted for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Sharing patterns, evolving stitches, and even writing their names in them. And somewhere I read that it was one of the few ways that women could, on a sort of subversive level, express political difference from their mate by sort of symbolically putting patterns of Tories versus the Whigs, let's say,
in
the quilt or in the stitchery.
Yes, there are many political patterns, as a matter of fact. So I think there's a great nugget of fascinating information there that needs to be looked at. But I, of course, as a poet, was delighted to discover this vast wealth of the titles and to make use of them as a refrain. And I think they work as a refrain because they are repetitious, but not totally repetitious. In other words, there is a similarity, but there is a diversity. And they do run through the poem, which, of course, is a long poem. And they do act literally as a thread to bind together the different parts of the poem.
Instead of taking the... Would you read some of these titles so that people who are not, in fact, familiar with... And I don't want to read them for you because I don't want to get the wrong cadence, but if you would just read some of these wonderful quilt pattern titles that are woven into the fabric of
this
poem.
Yes, yes. Road to Tennessee, Chinese Junk, Church, Frigate, Tide Wheel, Noon and Night, and Winged Square, Broad Arrow, and Courthouse Steps, Folded Love Letter, Christmas Star. The favorites are my star titles that I found, that I worked to glean from many places. I'll read just a few more of them. It's interesting, too. There again, I think there's something to explore. Why was there such an interest in stars? Broken Star, Blazing Star, Falling Star, Travel Star, Variable Star, Lemon Star, Star of Bethlehem, Christmas Star, Feathered Star, Star of Lemoyne, Cowboy's Star, Star of the West.
A lot of those women led very isolated lives and, in fact, spent time very distant and apart from other families, from community, and probably spent a lot of time looking at the night sky, I would imagine. Maybe in some ways the only free
on the way calm, to the outhouse.
calm breathing time that they had, and that perhaps hasn't changed. How do you find the time to write?
Well, I make the time, and it's always quite a battle, but I work usually early in the morning, which is my best time before I go to my job, and then at night. But my favorite time is early in the morning because it's quiet.
How early?
I had a
friend.
Well,
I think the tale is getting exaggerated and turning into a legend, which it doesn't deserve to be. I have said that I have gotten up and do get up as early as 3:30, and that's true. But I
We've
don't
seen
get
that
up.
In print, Sheila.
I know. And I would have to admit that is somewhat of an exaggeration. I do not get up every morning at 3:30 because some nights I go to bed at 12 or 1. But I do get up as early as 3:30, whatever my schedule will allow. Usually it's more like 5 o'clock, but it has to be early. Because
I write at 3:30 in the morning too, but only if I am still up.
No, I am an early morning person. The problem is, of course, with a family and many activities, I cannot go to bed early so often. I'm usually up until midnight or so, so I can't get up every morning at 3:30. But when I am really pressing to finish something, I will, and ordinarily I do get up at 5, and I find that that's how my biorhythm best works. I am just an early morning person. And there are virtually no interruptions at that hour of the morning, whereas there are likely to be late at night, especially with a family.
Let me ask you a question about that. Is there any connection between your creative power and your dreams?
There might well be. What I know is a very important part of my writing is the subconscious and the work that it is doing when I am asleep, and I train my subconscious to work for me. And my usual method of writing a poem is to start one early in the morning, to finish it as closely as I can, put it aside, go through my daily activities, and then late at night, just before I go to sleep, I intensely remember, look at, work on that poem, and say to myself, well, this line is wrong, or this word isn't right, or how am I going to choose between these two alternative lines? And I tell my subconscious to solve that problem while I sleep. And invariably, it does. As soon as I get going the next morning, I know that I have the answer because my subconscious has given it to me.
And it really is an invariable thing?
Very much so. I find that if I do not get that answer within 24 hours, I'm either never going to get it, or I'm not going to get it for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the time simply isn't right for that particular line or poem to be completed.
Mm-hmm. I do something very similar, although with less success, because it's not invariable with me, but I surely do crank in that part of my mind just before I go to sleep. And since I'm an early riser also, I see that connection. I feel like a cup that's just brimming over very often in the morning. And it's really better to be all by myself carrying that that full cup to the computer. And it does work overnight in the subconscious.
Jane, how long have you been writing? Have you been writing all your life?
All my life. I was one who I taught myself to read at some extremely early age, and as soon as I could read, then what I wanted to do was write, and I produced all kinds of things as a child. The only story that I remember was something that was, I remember the title, it was called The Little Red Shoes. They were ballet shoes. And apparently I had just found out that learning how to toe dance was very hard on your toes. And that was what that story was about. But then I shifted away from that form of writing and went into journalism. And curiously, I started writing stories for newspapers by the time I was 11 or 12. I can still remember when I first learned how. I thought that the quality of a story depended on the length of it. So I studied everything that was one paragraph long, you know, little fillers, until I could figure out how to do it myself, and I submitted those to the newspaper, and quite a few of them got published.
So the quality being tied to the brevity.
Yes.
The shorter the better.
Right.
Or the more you could say in a very compressed space.
Yeah, but it also had something to do with the fact that I was pretty young and was doing something rather perilous. And so I had to copy something that was very small.
We're going to start out with the Iliad. as your form. Pat, you also, I'm just interested at what point, since we have so few models, at what point did you decide writing was something special?
I was just thinking I should speak for those who write late at night, for those of you in the audience who are thinking, I can never be a writer because I can't get up at 5 a.m. I write late at night. It's interesting. I didn't realize, Jane, that you had taught yourself to read. I also taught myself to read. My parents taught me that one day they saw me laughing at the newspaper, and they said, "What are you laughing at?" And I read them a comic strip. And I have no memory of this particularly. But apparently I was reading by, I don't know, the age of 3 or something, and they could never figure out where I learned to do it. And I don't know either, except that I just knew that that's what you did. You read the comics. And so I learned on the comics.
Did your parents read to you a lot?
I don't think so. They read a fair amount, and so I have this picture in my mind of adults reading. I think that helps when you're a kid to see that, you know, adults engaged in it. My grandfather, who was turning 100 in a couple of months, was a very great influence because he was in Ireland. He was brought up in the hedge schools. He learned everything by memory. And he read voraciously, but he also memorized, and he recited poetry constantly. It was only when he turned 90 that I found out that some of the poems, the great old Irish poems that I grew up wondering why I never found in anthologies, that he had written. And we grew up thinking they were great Irish poems, like, "Whatever horrors do walk the night, there should be peace at home." That's one that
great Irish poem. Yes.
It goes on at great length. I mean, it's many verses long. But we all at that time were sort of learned to recite. We recited a lot. We sang and we recited, and that's sort of part of our family tradition. So I thought that was really natural. I thought people wrote poetry naturally. And when I first went to Ireland, I was surprised to find out how many people there also believe that. They haven't learned that people don't naturally write poetry. And the little town in Gort that I lived in had two poets who hated each other and spent a lot of time trying to get me into one camp or the other because they heard I was a poet. And poetry is, you know, people would say, my Uncle Ned, he writes sonnets, you know, that sort of thing. And that was my upbringing, was not thinking that poetry was odd. And so I just wrote poetry all the time, and I thought that that's what people did. When I got to be in high school, I found that nobody else was doing this. And this was rather shocking to me, and I felt very odd because it seemed like I was some misfit. About that time I realized that other people were WASPs and, you know, Protestants and stuff at the same time.
Well, it may have been more anachronistic and just out of time rather than... I have the impression that the more classic school education, and maybe Jane could help me on this, children from a very early age, at the early part of the century, had to memorize a poem a week. I went to school in Canada for a semester when I was in the sixth grade, which was in the 50s, and we all had to stand up and recite the poem of the week. You know, and if you were not clear on the poem at the beginning, by the time you had heard "In Flanders fields the poppies grow, between the crosses row on row 32 times, you had it. And I assumed that that was something to do. Why would you memorize poetry to recite if you weren't going to recite it? So yes. It must have been before our media deluge here of just constant things in the house that you can turn on to amuse yourself. It must have been more a part of everybody's life.
I think that's true, and I think I'm very lucky to have had that experience. I think that one problem with the media world is that it stresses novelty rather than repetition. And as a writer, I read things over and over. I memorize all my poems and I recite them to myself, working on them and tinkering with them. And I think that that's a real vital thing that a writer has to learn, to have the patience not to be seeking, you know, another poem tomorrow, but just keep working on the same thing. I still memorize poetry. I've been working on memorizing all of Yeats. That's my great ambition. I can do some short ones, but I won't. After I discovered that writing poetry every night, and I've always written every night for those of you who stay up late, was not what other people were doing, I spent a long time just divorced from the art until I was about 25. I just gave it up. I consciously gave it up. I thought, I am not going to be weird. I think I was weirder by giving it up. But I didn't know any poets. I didn't. That's not quite true. I had some people. I grew up in Anchorage, and there were some poets who taught in the high schools. But I didn't know how I would become that. So rather than risk what I perceived as the likely career of the woman poet, this is right about the same time Sylvia Plath killed herself. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading that in Time magazine and being terrified. Uh-oh, this is what happens if you pursue this path. And so I consciously gave it up, put it on the shelf, and said, I'm not going to do that, and went into journalism, as Jane mentioned, and really had a longing for a number of years to write poetry, and then I started writing again when I was in my mid-20s, just very tentatively, very short poems, and then hid them, and remained in the closet for about 5 years as I tried to tinker with my writing. And as a matter of fact, it was right after I had come out of the closet very tentatively that I met Sheila. Oh.
Where did you meet?
In Juneau.
Yes, yes. I think there's an interesting subject here, the fact that the three of us have been involved in journalism. I also started off as a newspaper reporter and editor, and mm-hmm. I still maintain that journalism is about the finest training that a writer in any medium can have. Because, as Jane, you were saying, you have to learn how to write something in a very, very concise manner. And, of course, in a newspaper, the cutting comes from the bottom up. So if you haven't gotten the salient information in early, it's not likely to appear in the article. And I think it's excellent, excellent training for poets or any kind of writers.
Besides that, there is a discipline.
Oh, yes.
Involved in the actual writing, just sitting down and doing it.
Mm.
Whether
yes.
you want to do it or you don't.
Exactly. And there is a time factor that is very important.
Yes. And learning how to work with all sorts of noise around you
yes.
Also helps.
In the studio with me are Jane Pender, Sheila Nickerson, Pat Monahan, and Sally Yari, and we're talking about women and writing and writing. In fact, writing is a difficult career for anyone, male or female, in this country at this time. It's hard. It's very hard to make a living on writing, even if you are a very good writer and, in fact, have had some things published. It's not a... There isn't a place where you can say, okay, now my career is set. I mean, that's not perhaps true of Michener or, you know, I mean, there are people whose careers are set. Barbara Cartland.
Mm. Oh, no. Barbara mm-hmm. Cartland's contract was just canceled because she's not selling well enough.
What?
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say that does happen. Publishers mm-hmm. do come and go, and editors come and go, and even some true. Well-known and widely selling writers get into binds when they lose an editor or a publishing house. Now, I think it's true that, except perhaps for James Michener and maybe half a dozen others, there really is no security in this line of work.
And yet you've described something that really takes a lot of discipline. You need to do it every day. In the case of most of you, you've had to do other things to make a living in process. And if you're a woman and have been a mother, we were talking... a little earlier, Sheila, about trying to steal time when you had three children underfoot.
Yes, the demands are very great. I have raised three children, and I've spent many years as a mother at home, and I know what it is to have those constant demands and distractions which fill all of the daytime hours and often many of the nighttime hours as well. And I think that is a difference that women writers experience from men, that they have much less control over the time. That is, if they have a family, they have much less control over their time than men do.
Elizabeth Cady Stanton said to Susan B. Anthony in a letter, I always worried that having children would ruin my writing because how could I write when the baby cried? But I found it was how could I write when the baby smiled.
I thought it was also interesting in Silences, which Tilly Olson wrote, she writes of many of the great recognized, acknowledged women writers like Gertrude Stein and Virginia Woolf are all childless.
Yes, and it's a long, long list. That is, to me, both frightening and challenging.
Yes.
And I think one of my private ambitions has been to see if I could do a little something to change that list. I do think it's possible to have children and write, but that is an awesome list.
Do you think that's changing now? That book was written,
I think,
what,
so.
12 to 15 years ago at least.
Yes, I would like to see Tilly Olson readdress that subject and provide some updated lists.
Some new information.
Yes, yes.
Mm. It is possible to be a mother and to be a writer. Is that the new message?
It has to be. It has to be possible. We'll make it possible.
It would be a sadness if we thought that we had to eliminate motherhood from our lives in order to accomplish some of the other tasks that are now part of our aspiration list. But the combining of it is not a simple matter, and writing isn't alone in terms of categories where it's problematic. In fact, writing in some way strikes me as somewhat compatible, at least in that it can be done at home. Now, it's true, when you're home, that is your work, and there's always probably dishes and to do and other things that are screaming in the home, come and do me, rather than sit down and write. And if you're trying to avoid the task of writing, there's lots of temptations that way. But it can be done on grab time, stolen time.
Buses. That's true.
Done on buses. Tilly Olson used to write in her kitchen on scraps of napkins and put the napkins away in drawers and pull them out later to use for her writing.
And, of course, Emily Dickinson used backs of envelopes when she was baking bread and going about domestic chores.
Do you think there's been a lot of women's writing that was written on scraps and so on that, in fact, is lost to us?
Yes, I mean, yes.
I know a woman poet in Anchorage who died about 10 years ago whose family burned her papers, not realizing. It's very sad. Just in the
they
loss.
They didn't even read them?
In the loss, they just consigned many pages to the flames. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows what was there.
I wanted to mention something whose meaning I don't know. Maybe somebody else has got some bright thoughts about it. This winter, I started to do something that I had had in mind for many years. My grandmother left a beautiful quilt. And the pattern, however, is not named beautifully. It's called Duck's Foot in the Mud.
Oh.
At any rate, it's gotten very elderly, and I decided that I would like to see if I could copy it, and have done about almost 10 of the squares. And as I worked on it, I found myself getting it. Now, this is the first quilt that I ever made. And I found myself getting into a kind of a rhythm. First of all, I began to understand more about my grandmother than I knew, simply from the way she placed her stitches and the way she made her pattern.
Told you something about her personality.
Yes, it seemed to. Mm-hmm. But then there was the rhythm of the work itself. Putting these little blocks together, the way you hold them, the way you stitch them, the way you press them. And it seemed almost to be a very old kind of a ritual for a woman, a repetitive job to which you also bring some artistry. It seemed important to me.
The thing about quilt making is that it's tangible and that it's very it's very usable. It's something that you're doing with your time that then your family can use. You seem to be talking about that a bit in the poem, the difference between doing practical things that you can lay out on the table and say, yes, I did this. This is real. This material is real. These stitches are real. That is more elusive about writing. Especially unpublished writing.
Yes, but I think we're getting very close to something that is important to me, and that is the difference between process and product. And what Jane is saying is that by going through the process, she learned and grew, and her awareness expanded. And to me, this is exactly what happens in writing. And I think sometimes, particularly when we are discussing such a subject as women's writing, we tend to overemphasize the product, and we forget that there is tremendous importance in the process, that even if Emily Dickinson's poems had been totally destroyed, her life would have been no less for that. In other words, we gain from the product, but she gained as a person through the process, even though she knew almost no publication in her lifetime. And I find that writing for me is a way of learning to increase in observation and learning to connect with all that is. And it is for me a way of gaining power. And I am very, very concerned with the process. And I don't like to have us think that everything depends on the product. Yes, we do need products, and we particularly now need products from women for all the reasons we have been discussing. But the ritual, the actual doing of the writing, is what can give us the increased awareness that we need simply to evolve as spiritual beings.
So that hour stolen at 3:30, 4:30 in the morning is in some ways more nurturing or more restorative than that hour of sleep for you.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's precisely it. I can give up the sleep, but I cannot give up that time, which gives me connection with my inner powers.
Well, I especially think for women it's a sort of taking back of self, because
yes.
they're so, especially yes. at the time in women's lives when they're raising young children, it's so difficult to control your schedule and to say that those needs and demands placed on you by young children who are dependent on you, it's so hard to say, okay, what I need is more important. You must wait. It's just an impossible thing. So in the process, many women, in fact, lose self and lose any kind of sense of themselves as separate and apart individuals.
I find that's very true.
So writing now, that was one of my questions, actually, that as we've been talking, I've been thinking about it. Writing it down versus just thinking those quiet thoughts, there must be some drive on the part of a writer to share, to make those feelings concrete if they're involved in the process of writing versus thinking or daydreaming.
It seems that it's not just leaving the product. The process of writing is different than the process of thinking. If you sit in a chair and meditate and think, there's a different process than if you enter the realm of language in which one word must follow another and your pen must keep moving. And often in the writing, you say something that you didn't intend to think. The writing itself becomes a way of thinking. And in talking about the process, thinking about making that quilt, Jane, would be quite different than making the quilt.
Yes.
And it's not really the fact of leaving the product. It's the fact of engaging in a physical physicalization of the thought.
So it's like forcing definition, forcing refinement.
Well, to me, it's discovery. It is literally the way to discover, again, what is inside us. It's all there. We don't have to go and take a trip or take a course or learn anything. Everything is there, but how to get at it is the question. And to me, it is the writing that brings about the discovery. In other words, it's the vehicle or the channel for the discovery, and that to me is what is ultimately important.
Back to the quest, the journey that
yes.
we were talking about
yes.
earlier.
And I think this is a way to speed up the journey and to get more quickly into what is there. To me, writing is a psychotechnology, just the way some people use yoga or transcendental meditation or dervish dancing or a thousand other techniques. Writing, for me, works as a psychotechnology. In other words, the quickest way in to connect with my inner powers.
You've written other things besides poetry.
Yes, I have written novels. One novel has been published, and most recently a nonfiction book called Writers in the Public Library, which deals with the subject of writing residencies in public library systems, of which there have been very few.
Sheila, you said yesterday or last night that you're working on another long poem.
Yes.
Would you share some of that with us?
Yes, I am working now on another long poem, which has the working title of A Chapter in the History of the North Star. And it is going to be giant in terms of what I used to write, which was mostly the little lyric, and it is going to deal with the power of the North, with the power of the geographic point of the North. I'm very interested in the North Pole, in Arctic exploration. I'm very interested in astronomy. A lot of it is going to have to do with the North Star and with a lot of related items, radio astronomy, and then with some very real, concrete, physical activities and people and events in Arctic history. And somehow, I know it will all come together. I can't tell you just how right now, but I have great faith that, again, through this discovery process, you see, to me, this is like another kind of journey I have embarked on this poem. And I know generally where it will take me, but I could not possibly tell you right now what the explicit steps are to the final goal. But I do literally have faith that those steps will be given to me as I move along. And it's remarkable how right in the middle of everything I will suddenly have an illumination. Ah, yes, that subject will connect these two parts. And, oh, yes, I've got to find out about that. And I know that my mind is working again. This is the subconscious right in the middle of everything else. And piece by piece, this poem is coming to me. And it is totally a discovery process. I'm as surprised as a totally objective reader would be, because I simply need to go through enough writing and enough living and enough experiencing to find out what those steps are.
It's a great image. It's seeing the figures in the stars, as in the old, all the names that we have. It's, let's see, I'm getting tongue-tied here. As there are patterns and quilts, there are also patterns in the stars, and different people have seen different patterns and different meanings and made a whole mythology around that. So,
and we live under different astronomical patterns depending on where physically in the world we live, which is another interesting aspect.
And our Alaskan orientation is unique. We are sort of on the top looking down, or...
Oh dear! I hope this doesn't take too long, Sheila, because I've become an addict of Sheila's long poems as a result of The Quilt Maker, which I've read over and over again.
I appreciate that, and your enthusiasm will spur me on.
Send me
a little
bit.
It's like waiting for the next in the trilogy.
I do happen to have a chunk with me.
Oh well, wonderful.
You're moving more and more then in the direction of long poems, do you think?
Yes, I am increasingly interested in the form of the long poem. To me, it is the novel of the poem. It is a way of looking at a subject from many different angles and then leaving to the reader the ultimate choice as to which is the more effective angle through which to look. And I find this intriguing. In other words, it is taking the moment of illumination that we try to achieve in a short poem and expanding it enormously so that there are many, many points of illumination. But
like a star.
Exactly. Like a star, exactly.
Sure.
And again, it's a choice left to the reader as to which is the right moment of illumination through which to look at whatever the subject is.
So we are going to get a woman-written Iliad after
all. Oh, that's a wonderful thought. Why not?
That I can't wait.
Why not?
I can't. The other thing that I love about the reading of poetry is that you can pick it up anywhere.
Yes.
Since your book has been around, I do pick it up and just dive in sometimes at odd places. There isn't a necessary or required starting point.
Yes, I think that's very true of any poem that works, and I'm really delighted to hear you say that. Because there is a unity in a poem, if the poem is working, so that all things do come together. And I think that's one of the marks of a poem.
And I guess one of the part of the message that we've been talking about this morning is that for at least for three of you in the studio with me, the experience of writing, the process of writing, has in fact helped you reach that unity as a person that everyone needs to do in order to feel sort of self-sustained and in charge, I guess, of your own course and future. Well, it's been a very interesting conversation from my point of view. I've been talking with Sheila Nickerson, guest from Juneau, and previous Alaskan poet laureate, Pat Monahan, Sally Yari, Jane Pender. I thank you all very much for being with me in the studio today. I've been your host, Patty Kostelic. The executive producer has been Carla Tonella.